Hello and welcome to the Big Happy Life podcast. It's been a long time since I published an episode. Not so long since I recorded, mind you. I actually do have an episode that was meant to go out before this one, but I'll tell you about that in a second. So I'm taking a little break from the format of the Big Happy Life podcast, which has always been about helping us feel more in control, helping us weather the tough stuff, and helping us be great role models for our kids. The podcast is still about those three things, but I'm on a little bit of a personal quest at the moment because I'm trying to figure out what it takes to live life as an expression of joy rather than in the pursuit of happiness. And so I've set myself this goal, target of writing a blog every day for 100 days just to help focus my attention on really trying to figure that out. Because I'm very much a believer in the fact that we need to aim at the thing that we want rather than try and get away from the thing that we don't want. And that was why I called Big Happy Life, Big Happy Life, because I was like, I want my big life to feel happy. But what I'm gradually realizing is that the pursuit of happiness can be the very thing that gets in the way of feeling like you have a life that's well lived. And so this kind of podcast series within the podcast is really part of my kind of personal journey of figuring out that sense of living a life as an expression of joy, bringing joy to the world as a result of being in it, and how you do that and what that involves. And so my guest today is a lady who really epitomizes that. Her name is Tanya Hackney, and she's the author of a book called Leaving the Safe Harbor, The Risks and Rewards of Raising a Family on a Boat. I actually recorded an episode of the podcast with Tanya a few months ago, but I hadn't yet published it. And when I started on this journey, she was really on my mind as somebody who I felt kind of epitomized the thing I'm trying to grapple with and make sense of. And so I was really keen to talk to her again, and very fortunately she agreed to have a second conversation with me. And oh my gosh, it does not disappoint. She has so many incredible pearls of wisdom to share, and she just helped me make sense of some of the things that I haven't yet been able to make sense of. And so if you are somebody who is also grappling with, you know, life's big questions, who am I, where do I fit, what's the point of it all? And you're thinking about how to live in a way that brings meaning and joy as a result of you being here, then this conversation is for you. Oh, before I forget, the internet connection wasn't 100% stable throughout the entire conversation. So there are one or two points where the sound is a little bit glitchy, but I didn't want to cut those parts of the conversation because they were kind of relevant to the bigger picture. So I've left those in. So with that said, we're going straight in, and you'll hear a little bit about what's been happening in Tanya's life most recently, and also some of the adventures that she and her family have shared. Her life really is just this remarkable mix of experiences, and I think that's what gives her such a wealth of wisdom and knowledge to share with us. So let's dive in.
Yeah, so we've been here for a couple of months. We've got one of our kids graduated. We've got another one off to the Coast Guard in 1 month. We've got a nephew that's been married off. I'm trying to take care of my mom and Jay's dad, who are having, both of them having crazy medical difficulties. I'm trying to think, there have been like multiple major family milestones just in the time we've been here. And I've planned a homeschool unit with my brother's wife, who also homeschools her kids. And so my daughter, who's 12, and her five youngest cousins have been doing field trips every week out into the Everglades.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's been amazing. We went on a swamp walk with a naturalist, a botany expert, and he was able to tell us about all the plants around us. And we were wading in waist to chest deep water in a cypress stand, which is one of the coolest hikes I've ever done.
Wow. See, this is why I wanted to talk to you. You're the lady who's got to connect us with joy.
Oh, it was so great. Like in the middle of everything, when people ask me, oh, how are you? We've missed you so much because I, you know, left my friends in the Keys. I'm like, I'm wonderful and terrible. Like always, always at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm watching my mom and Jay's dad fall apart and it's the season of goodbyes. You know, I've entered this sort of autumn of my life where we're helping our kids start their adventures, which is hard because we're saying goodbye. Just the upshot of that is that my life is often, I mean, I'm trying to think who's, maybe it was Rick Warren's quote that said that life isn't a series of hills and valleys. It's more like train tracks with the good things running alongside the bad things. And so if you ask me how I am, I'm wonderful and terrible at the same time.
I love that. I love that. I think, again, with this kind of topic, you honestly, you entered my head straight away with the idea of living with a view to live as an expression of joy. And because it feels to me like that has been at the heart of why you chose the life you chose. Is that fair to say?
For sure. Yes, because I think we might say or believe that money doesn't buy happiness, but our actions are not consistent with our words. And I think I started to realize that our actions weren't consistent with our words. What we said was we wanted to collect verbs and not nouns. We wanted to live, you know, a joyful, happy adventure and make memories with our family. But instead, what we were doing was all the normal things. I think one of the things that really, maybe a moment that I realized that was there was a Christmas morning with my little kids. And you know, Christmas with kids is so fun. It's so fun. You get to recapture the joy of your youthful Christmases watching your kids experience it. The whole thing, unwrapping the presents and the fun treats that I had hidden in the stockings and making my mom's sweet roll recipe, like all of those traditions that I remember these joyful moments from childhood. But on the flip side, I also realized that there was sort of a toy orgy that happens on Christmas morning. You know, people frantically unwrapping things and ripping things open. And then there's like this pile and a mess around you. And then they might be like fighting over something. And you're like, this is so weird. We try to tell our kids that money doesn't buy happiness and that things won't make you happy. That really makes you happy is relationships. Well, we had given them, you know, a dopamine hit by giving them a bunch of new things. And I thought about, you know, my own relationship with things. Like I have a sundress addiction. Like I just love sundresses. And I would justify the purchase of a sundress because I'd be like, well, I'm not Jay, two cases of beer. That's one sundress. I could buy a sundress every week and we would be, you know, even. But I would also have, you know, a massive closet full of sundresses that I couldn't possibly wear all of them. So I started thinking about the consistency of words and actions. And this was long before we bought the boat. And I think buying the boat, the first Christmas that we were traveling with our kids, we went to the Bahamas and I didn't bring very much with us because I didn't really know what I was going to find. I made an assumption that people have Christmas everywhere and that, you know, there are stores everywhere. It's not like I wasn't going to be able to find anything, but I didn't know how remote we were going to be. I didn't know what island grocery stores were like. And I had brought like a jigsaw puzzle and some of the kids' favorite candy because I didn't know what I was going to find in another country. And then it turns out that for Christmas, we were anchored in this very remote location on Highbourne Key. There were no stores. There was no stuffing the stockings except for the few things that I had brought. There were no presents under our tree. And we did have a teeny tiny tree that we put up, you know, looks like the Charlie Brown Christmas tree. So there were no presents under the tree. I did make my mom's cinnamon roll recipe because that's, you know, my favorite Christmas tradition. And there was no toy orgy that morning. And I was a little nervous about how that was going to be. Just, you know, we actually had a phone call with the cousins later. We were able to get through a Skype call with my brother's family. And when the kids asked, how was your Christmas? I was cringing. I'm like, oh, they're going to say there was no Christmas this year. There were, you know, no presents. But when I heard my kids explaining, this morning we got to go snorkeling in the octopus's garden and we did a jigsaw puzzle and we had candy in our stockings because they were not expecting anything. I had warned them. I'm like, this is going to be an adventure Christmas. I felt like we had arrived. I was like, oh my gosh, we don't need all that stuff. Finally, for the first time, what we said and what we did was consistent and true and, you know, integrated. We said money doesn't bring you happiness. Relationships and memories make you happy. And there was a Christmas that proved that the memories and the relationships were enough and that we didn't need, you know, foil wrapped boxes. And we've tried to be consistent with that over the years where we take Christmas money, we call it the fun money. And instead of buying things, we plan a trip or we go do something awesome. Or like 1 year we took the fun money and bought 2 kayaks. We still have those 2 kayaks. Those gifts have just continued to give. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things don't end up in landfills. You know, memories stay with you for a long, long time.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I find your family so inspiring. I really do. I think what you've said about the consistency of words and actions is so important. I suppose I've always referred to it as values. Like, mm-hmm. I remember recording a podcast, this was years ago now. I recorded a podcast about actual values and aspirational values. And I think a lot of us have aspirational values. We want to value our health. We want to value our family. We want to value our memories. But then our actual values, the things that we do end up prioritizing and living by, are the house and the money and the car and all those things. But I guess, you know, a little part of me as I'm standing here in the house, looking out at the car and thinking about, you know, my business and its ability to generate money, I'm kind of like, I don't know that my route to joy is going to be the same as yours. I don't think I have that spirit of adventure. So I guess my question then is, for people who are going to stay living really in the traditional, what lessons have you learned that could apply even if you don't uproot and sell and have the big adventure?
That's a wonderful question because you are absolutely right. I don't think that many people would want to do what we have done, pack up everything, sell everything, and move on to a boat and go sailing on the ocean. It is terrifying. I'm not going to lie. Like, it's a scary, scary life. It's as scary as it is wonderful. Again, that train track of things are wonderful, things are horrible. Maybe not everybody wants to live, you know, on that edge. But a lot of the things that we've chosen are things anyone could choose. So one of the priorities that we set is family dinner. So even with our teenagers, where they have this crazy schedule for the last couple of years, it's youth group one night and jujitsu 2 nights a week. And I can't remember, there was another activity. There was always something going on. And my other daughter was always at dance on Tuesday nights. So family dinner was always a priority. It just got later. Because for whatever reason, at least in the United States, you know, and a conspiracy theorist would say that it was like intentional to tear the family apart, but all the activities are in the evening at a time when historically or traditionally you would be coming in from the day's work and gathering as a family to eat. And you now have this fractured group of people, one person's at jujitsu and one person's at youth group and one person's at, and this completely tears the fabric of the family apart because there's no coming together to talk about your day and to transmit culture and manners and demonstrate what conflict resolution looks like. I mean, those are really important things that happen at mealtimes. And so my refusal to compromise means that dinner is at 9 o'clock. Sometimes 10 o'clock, like dinner is whenever everybody's done for the day and we are all in the same place and I'm cooking from scratch. So it's like, I come home from dropping my daughter off at dance and I start cooking. I'm like starting dinner at 7:30. Most people are done with dinner at 7:30, but it's because I absolutely refuse to give that up. I want my cake and to eat it too. And as a result, we're eating really late and I don't really like that. I would prefer to have dinner done and over with earlier. I think it probably would be better for our physical health, but I'm not really willing to sacrifice the, you know, mental and spiritual health of our family to put dinner on early. And then, you know, at 5 o'clock before everybody leaves for their activities, my kids don't want to eat a big meal right before they you know, roll around on the floor and try and choke each other. So eating early hasn't been an option either. So that's just one small way I would say that anybody can prioritize family dinner, even if it's, I mean, I read that it's so rare that a family sits down at a table to eat together without any devices that I would say you could start with one night a week where you say Sunday night is family night. You're not going to be at a friend's house. You're not going to have your phone at the table. I'm making a meal from scratch and we are going to actually sit down at such and such a time and not get up until we've had like a meal together. And it's going to be uncomfortable if it's not in your, you know, habits to do that, but you can build something new, you know, one night at a time. And for us, it's every single night. It's huge. It's really, really huge. Something very small, like prioritizing a meal together.
I love that. I love what you just said. You can build something new one night at a time. Because that is what it's all about, isn't it? Just one day, one night, one choice at a time.
Yeah, it's not like I woke up and I sold all my stuff and I ended up on a boat. That was the result of a thousand tiny little decisions where we pointed our feet in the direction that we wanted to go. And we took one step and one step and one step. And yes, I woke up this morning and I'm in the cabin of a 48-foot catamaran. And, you know, my husband is asking me if I can put the jib back on because we've just had a sail repaired. And those things are now normal to me, you know, but it wasn't. I was like living the yuppie lifestyle. I lived in a little three bedroom, two bath with a white picket fence in Atlanta, Georgia. And there were three cars in the driveway and those aren't bad things. And actually I feel really grateful. We need some stuff in our lives. What happens when we think that we own our stuff, but eventually our stuff owns us. And so I think we have to hold on to those things very lightly. I do have a vehicle. I love that thing. It's a 20-year-old Chevy Suburban and it's taken our family everywhere and it keeps breaking down. And we're like, should we buy a new car? Should we, you know, keep fixing the old car? And we still have to think about all those normal things. But I don't want to say I don't care, but like, I really don't care. We rented a car while it was in the shop recently and it was, you know, a new car with all the whistles and bells and I hated it. I was like, a vehicle is a way to get from point A to point B, what color it is, what the interior looks like, you know, I no longer care about those things is what I'm saying. My core values are aligned with my, you know, the daily act of living and what I prioritize.
Yeah. Yeah. So, as you know, this podcast or this particular series within the podcast is around my desire to do a little of what you've done, to point my feet in the direction of where I want to go and figure out one decision, one step at a time, how to do that. And so the thing that I'm kind of pointing towards is making my life an expression of joy rather than a pursuit of happiness. Because I think that's where we can end up with this divide in our values, or we can end up being inconsistent with words and actions, is we seek pleasure and happiness rather than seek to bring something to the world that's joyful.
Mm-hmm. So I think about this too, and I think I may have sent you the quote, but I actually printed it up because I thought this might come up in our conversation. I read C.S. Lewis's memoir, Surprised by Joy. I'm trying to think what the subtitle is. I wrote it here somewhere. Oh, Surprised by Joy, The Shape of My Early Life. And he was an intellectual. He was at Oxford College in England. And he was a linguist and he was very logical. He's a wonderful, wonderful writer. People might know him from The Chronicles of Narnia, which I've read to my kids many times, or The Space Trilogy, which is a really cool science fiction series he wrote for adults. But he's more often known as a Christian theologian or apologeticist, where he sort of defends Christian belief, but he was late to the game. He didn't convert to Christianity till much, much later in his life. But he's sort of tracing his understanding of joy as he's looking back at his life. What were the seeds that sprouted into this, you know, longing to make peace with God, which so the book documents his own conversion. And this is kind of a lengthy quote, but this is his distinction between joy, happiness, and pleasure, which is what you just mentioned. "I call it joy," he says. Animal land was not imaginative, but certain other experiences were. The first is itself of the memory of a memory. As I stood beside a flowering currant bush on a summer day, there suddenly arose in me without warning, and as if from a depth not of years but of centuries, the memory of that earlier morning at the old house when my brother had brought his toy garden into the nursery. It is difficult to find words strong enough for the sensation which came over me. Milton's enormous bliss of Eden, giving the full ancient meaning to enormous, comes somewhere near it. It was a sensation, of course, of desire. But desire for what? Before I knew what I desired, the desire itself was gone, the whole glimpse withdrawn. The world turned commonplace again, or only stirred by a longing for the longing that had just ceased. In a sense, the central story of my life is about nothing else. The quality common to these experiences is that of an unsatisfied desire, which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. I call it joy, which is here a technical term and must be sharply distinguished both from happiness and pleasure. Joy, in my sense, has indeed one characteristic and one only in common with them. The fact that anyone who has experienced it will want it again. I doubt whether anyone who has tasted it would ever, if both were in his power, to exchange it for all the pleasure in the world. But then joy is never in our power, and pleasure often is. So he's describing this memory that he has and this sense of longing that it aroused in him. And I'm thinking from my own life, waking from a dream, like a beautiful dream. And as you wake, even as you wake, you're forgetting it. And you want to like close your eyes and get back into that dream. I'm sure that's an experience, kind of a universal experience. And what is the quality of that dream that you want to climb back into? And I think he would call that joy. It's a longing that is itself both painful and pleasurable at the same time. And I think that what we understand about life on planet Earth is that love is never untouched by loss. That's part of the arrangement, this side of heaven, that which we love is passing away, whether it's a person or a thing or a memory or a dream. Everything has, you know, decay built into it. And that's really, really painful. And so we actually build walls to protect ourselves from this pain. So when you wall yourself off from being hurt, say you've fallen in love and someone's broken your heart, well, fool me once, shame on me, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. I'm never going to let that happen again. And so we wall off a little piece of our heart to protect ourselves from injury so that the next time we fall in love, we keep a little piece of ourselves away and safe from injury. And maybe this happens many times and we wall off more and more of our heart so that we will, you know, suffer less and less loss. But what happens as a result, of course, is that you wall off your heart and then you can also not experience joy and love, because walling off from pain is by its very nature a wall against joy and the fullness of joy. To open yourself up to love and joy is to open yourself up to injury over and over and over again. And unless you know how to handle that hurt, how to forgive, how to let go, how to hold lightly, then that's the natural, you know, I guess, biological response to protect yourself. And so people find different ways of dealing with that hurt. Not everybody walls things off. Some people, you know, we mishandle pain all the time. We drug ourselves, we protect ourselves, we, you know, drink ourselves, you know, into oblivion. We get addicted to all sorts of things. We, you know, try and fill the emptiness with so many, many different things. And the only way that I have found, I guess, to live lightly and to live in this pursuit of joy, knowing that it carries with it longing and pain, is to walk with God. I don't have anywhere other receptacle for unloading all of the hard things, except for in my prayer life.
Mm-hmm.
So I can talk more about that if you'd like me to. I feel like I'm rambling at this point.
That was so wonderful. And it really, that helped me so much. I'm not even sure I have words. I almost feel like I want to close off here because I think what you just created was exactly the moment that you described with the quote. Because aww. I felt it arise. I felt the connection with what you were talking about. I felt it kind of swell in my body of a sense of...
and then it like wisps away.
Yes, when you try and make it into words, it evaporates. It's extraordinary. Yeah. But I think the piece that came to me, I think is the same thing I've been grappling with. This is a kind of 100-day blog journey for me that I thought...
Yes, and I've been reading your blogs and I love them. I love them.
Thank you.
Yeah, so much. And I'm really, they resonate with me so deeply. You know, almost every day it's something that you've said that I'm like, yes, yes. Like to me, I'm not saying that I've reached any kind of destination. I'm also on this path with you and on this journey. I'm saying, yes, we are, you and I are on this journey together. And I feel like we are on the right path. When I'm reading your blogs, I'm like, yes, we are on the right path.
Oh, I'm so delighted. Thank you. I was just like, I feel like I'm grappling with the same thing over and over, but this feels like something that it's hard to hold on to. It does wisp and fly away. But what you said, I think it helped me with the thing that I was grappling with, which is the sense of, I think in order to notice joy, feel it, and make life an expression of it, one has to be okay with the other side of the coin. Like you don't get to have just one side of the coin. You either get the coin with both of its sides or you put the coin down and then you don't have either.
Oh, I just got chills. That's it. That's it exactly. You have put it into words. Good for you. You did what I couldn't do in 15 minutes of rambling. Yes, you are absolutely right. I think that that is true. So I don't know if last time we spoke about it, but I had suffered like this horrible loss last October. Did we talk about Mary? And my death watch with her. So Jay's stepmom is only about 12 years older than I am. His dad remarried a much younger woman. And she and I became very, very close. I would describe her more as a big sister than as, you know, a mother-in-law. But I'm lucky. I have two mother-in-laws and I love them both. I adore them. And Mary and I were very, very close. And she was 59 and she got pancreatic cancer. And she put up a very brave fight. And I hate the language that we use around cancer, that it's sort of a war, because it's actually a war with our own bodies. You know, our bodies created this thing and our bodies have the capacity to heal it. And we bombard it with almost like the nuclear option. I have developed opinions about cancer in the last couple of years. But the treatment was so awful. I mean, it was so awful. It does create a war zone in your body. And watching her die slowly, or actually rather quickly, because pancreatic cancer it's quick and dirty and very, very painful. Over the course of 6 months, I just watched her, you know, literally like slip away. And then I got this call. I was coming for the weekend. I was spending 1 week a month away from my family. I would bring maybe one kid with me and they would go visit their cousins. And I was driving from the Florida Keys where my boat was up to Naples where my family was, and spending this time with her because I knew that the time was short, or suspected statistically, like the survival rate for 1 year is 20%. And by 2 years, only 10% of the people who get pancreatic cancer are still alive. So I prioritized this time with her. And then I thought I was just going for a weekend to see her last October. And in the car, like right before I was getting in the car, my father-in-law called and said, Mary's been in the hospital overnight and she's had a stroke. And they're no longer doing treatment and they've decided to move her to hospice. So this went from Mary seeking treatment and this might still have a, you know, a happy ending, to I'm now going to sit by her deathbed. And I was wrecked. I mean, just, I didn't even know how to grapple with that. And so I went to my little spot where I do morning yoga and I, you know, just literally fell on my face in child's pose. And I was crying and I was praying and crying. And I was like, God, I don't think that I can do this. I don't think I can go. I don't think I can say goodbye to this person that I love so much. And I hear, I don't want to say it's audible, but I hear a voice that speaks to me very clearly. It usually says something counterintuitive. So it's not like, I know what my voice sounds like. It sounds like a broken record. Usually God's voice sort of breaks in and interrupts that flow of repetitive thinking. And what I heard in that moment was, you don't have to do this. I'll take care of it. You just need to show up. And I was like, okay, I don't have to do it. I just have to show up and God's going to do the rest. So I got in the car and I drove to this hospice center and I spent the next 5 days. We split up sort of that watch, that death watch, just like we would a ship's passage. Now, Mary and her husband, Al, my husband's father, are sailors, and we've done many passages with them and buddy boated with them. It was this passion that we shared and, you know, spent time in the exotic locations with grandma and grandpa. My kids, you know, love these adventure grandparents. So we split it up like an ocean passage where I took the night watch and then Jay's dad took the day watch. And then every evening we would take 2 hours of reprieve. One of Mary's friends would come and sit by her bedside and we would go have dinner together to decompress and talk about things. And it was just about perfect. I mean, if you can say you enjoyed sitting by the bedside of someone you loved, I can say there was actually joy in that. It was the most unexpected thing. I did not expect to feel joy during that period of time. I expected all the other things, like just the physical horror of watching someone die. Like, death is ugly. It is an ugly, ugly process. That person sort of being taken from you, you know, moment by moment, their lifeblood literally like draining away, it is a horrific thing to watch. But here's the but that I wasn't expecting. Sitting by her bedside and holding her hand and praying with her and singing to her and reading aloud to her and having the conversations that we could have, there were very few of them. Every time she would open her eyes and notice it was me, she would say, "Thank you for being here." And sometimes that was all she could say. And I was like, imagine if I had said, "I can't do this. This is too hard." And I wasn't there. Like, here she is. She didn't want to walk alone. Like, no one should have to walk alone through the valley of the shadow of death. You should walk them holding their hand as long as you can so that they know they are loved and that they're not alone. And that's what I would want. You know, if you love others as you love yourself, you know, then you would do for them what you would want done for you. And I don't want to go, you know, alone into the valley of death. So I held her hand. It was an act of courage because none of it was nice. But in that moment, I did experience an inexpressible joy. Mm-hmm. I mean, akin to ecstasy, like you're witnessing this passing from, you know, one place into the next. And I don't know exactly what comes next, but she went with peace to meet her maker and she had made peace with her maker. And so she wasn't going in kicking and screaming, angry or full of regret or full of bitterness. She went lightly and I witnessed this amazing thing. And I said, whatever it is that she had, that's what I want. I also would like to go that way. You know, this sort of release and acceptance. And I experienced so much joy. I actually threw her a death day party. I know it sounds crazy. I hope it's an idea that catches on. 6 months before she died, she had a group of friends for an evening of prayer and healing and at a friend's house. And at the end of this evening where we had laid hands on her and prayed for her, and one of her friends is a shaman, and we had had this rose petal ceremony. It was a little bit woo-woo for me, but at the end of that evening, we were all standing around her and she said, "Well, I'm planning on surviving this, but if I don't, you girls are the ones I want around my deathbed." And I remembered that she said that. And so when I was at the hospice center, I called all of them and I said, "Okay, it's time. I want you to come for a party. I want balloons, flowers, chocolate." Mary loved chocolate. "Bring chocolate. Bring a song or a poem or something to share, something you'd love to send her out with. We're going to have a going away party." And we threw a party in hospice and we laughed and we cried and we said those things that sometimes you don't get to say to someone. It was a wonderful, horrible experience. That's all I can tell you. that I think I could have explained to you what joy was, that you can have joy in the middle of heartbreak. But until I experienced it, I didn't really know what joy was. But now I know that it's real. There's no explanation for how you can feel that, again, putting it into words, that experience of ecstasy while your heart is breaking. I just didn't even know that that was possible. I suspected it, but now I know that it is. The joy, and if you can experience joy in the middle of saying goodbye, in the middle of, you know, a horrific, painful death, then you can experience joy in all the little things. Like, man, that's the worst case scenario. If you can experience joy in the worst case scenario, then you can deal with everything else that is thrown your way.
Oh, that's such a powerful story. And again, you've helped me with another piece of it, because what you've just described is you didn't fight what was, and that if you're fighting what is happening and it's the unfairness and the awfulness of it and it shouldn't be happening and what if and all of that stuff, like all of that bars the door to the possibility of that being the experience you had. And so that's what
yes.
the letting go, the holding lightly.
Yes. Because if I had been angry, if I had been angry that this had happened to her, if I had been angry at the doctors, if I had been, one of her friends who was also seeking cancer treatment was really angry. I was surprised at the vitriol that she expressed, but she felt that the doctors had offered her false hope and that Mary was now suffering in a way that she didn't have to suffer because, you know, they had made this promise that they couldn't keep. But Mary wasn't angry. Mary had released all of that anger. And a big piece of holding lightly is forgiveness. And I actually, in my journal, spend a lot of time on my, you know, I talked about doing the miracle mornings. In my morning quiet time, I spend a lot of time dealing with my own negative feelings, anxiety and anger and frustration and guilt. And I, you know, I'm pulling it out. I don't really want to swallow it and I don't want to vent. I just want to deal with it and hand it to God. So I pull it out and I'm like, look at this thing. What is this? Why am I angry? Am I really angry? You know, sometimes anger is a mask for much deeper emotion. Sometimes it's something from my childhood. And at the end of the session of pulling this thing out and looking at it, I then give it to God. I'm like, I don't want to carry this poisonous thing around anymore. Like, I've been angry, you know, at my parents because of this mistake they made. And I'm playing God by judging them for this mistake that they made. The mistake they made is probably because they themselves are wounded people. And I literally give it to God and I say, here, I'm not saying that what they did was right. I'm saying I was injured by this, but I don't want to hold them accountable for it anymore. I will let you hold them accountable. You can give them mercy and grace or judgment as you see fit, but I will no longer carry this poisonous thing around with me. And that lightens my load. I'm no longer dragging around this steamer trunk full of emotional baggage. I'm letting it go. And when you start that process and you begin to do it in real time, like it takes a long time to sort of play catch up. If you've been carrying around all the wounds from your entire life, you know, your entire childhood, and who of us doesn't have some trauma in our childhoods, then it takes a while to get to the bottom of all of that. And once you get to the bottom and you're no longer carrying a steamer trunk, maybe you've got like a wallet, you know, a few things left. Then when something new comes up, when, you know, I had a really unpleasant conversation with my sister about a year ago, and I realized I was really still hurting from this conversation. Once I realized that, I was like irritated with her, but the thing she did wasn't, you know, I shouldn't have been angry about it. So I was like, okay, I'm still angry about something. And I went back and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm still hurt about this. I need to surrender that again. And so the acceptance and the ability to travel lightly comes from this place of forgiveness. And quite frankly, I would say as a believer in Jesus, I don't know how else I would be able to write this off unless I understood that I am loved and forgiven and that my debts were also written off. So all of this peace and joy and lightness and love, the ability to accept and love someone no matter if they've hurt me or not, comes from being loved by God and accepting that love and accepting that I'm loved, because, you know, I have like worthiness issues and, you know, all that crap from childhood. But the ability to forgive and to be forgiven has totally set me free from bitterness and anxiety. And like, I just have this place where I can put all of that negative crap and not drag it around with me.
Yeah.
And then I can just deal with things as they come. I don't have to carry it around. So it keeps me light. It doesn't weigh me down again. You know, I don't have to carry a big burden and then release it, carry a big burden. It's not a cycle. It's, you know, not once and done either. You have to continue to surrender.
Yeah.
But it's a powerful way to live. Like, I don't know, like you start talking about Jesus and people sort of glaze over or they get angry, but I'm like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, this is what happened to me. I feel amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny actually, because I can't remember if it was a video I watched or something that I read. I can't remember now, but it was something about how much conflict comes with religion and how one person believes something and another person's like, no, that's not true. It's something else. And he said, but when you survey a large population across the globe and ask them, do you believe in something else, something bigger than you? The vast majority say yes. We call it something else. We have perhaps different beliefs underneath the belief about whatever the big thing is. But ultimately, all of us believe in something being there.
It's like hard. I think it's hardwired in. And I think C.S. Lewis would make that same argument, that it's hardwired. Like, something about us longs for meaning. And when people say, oh, you know, I don't believe in fairy tales, I would say, like, nobody actually knows, you know, those three core questions: who am I, what am I doing here, and where am I going? Those questions are all deep faith questions. And some of us answer those questions, you know, by probing science. And some of us answer those questions by probing religion. And others, I would not necessarily say that I'm religious, because I view religious as being a set of rules and rituals. Others of us, you know, probe that through relationship. I would say that I have a relationship with God, not, you know, I have to do this or do that in order to please God. You know, I don't, not by obligation, but by choice and love and free will. I do agree with you that we are all seeking that. And that at the end, the answer to those questions, who am I, where am I going, and, you know, what is it all for, are deeply religious questions. Even if you're answering those questions, you know, with science, and you're saying, well, it's all a big accident, and, you know, I don't believe there's anything afterward, and maybe you end up with, you know, nihilism. You know, in the end, these are religious and spiritual questions.
Yeah.
Even if we choose to attack the question from,
yeah. Well, again,
from science.
The way we look at it, the way I've often looked at it, and even when I'm running corporate workshops, people will grapple with something as to whether it's true or not true. But when you talk about, like, some of the beliefs that we have, you talked about unworthiness and, you know, some of the things that you grapple with, and that has a belief system underneath it. Some of our beliefs are helpful and others are not. And so a part of me often thinks, like, let's say you have faith, and it turns out at the end you were wrong. Did you live a life that felt better because of the faith you had? And if so, surely that was the goal in the first place.
That's good enough. I'm with you. I think, right, right. If heaven is real, that's a bonus. That's gravy. Even if heaven isn't real, even if it is a fairy tale, the motivation that led me to seek this relationship with God isn't that I would be rewarded someday. It's that I would, you know, walk in such a way that I would be free and light and full of love and leave this place better than I found it. And in the end, even if the rest of it isn't real, I agree with you that it already served its purpose. In a sense, even if it's not real, it still saved me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I am not a Christian. I was when I was a teenager, and, you know, I've poured myself so deeply into it. And my beliefs have changed, but I believe the same thing as you. I just believe it differently. And as you say, like, even if both of us are wrong, I think our beliefs help us live a life that is in service to a good life. Mm-hmm. And I think feeling like it's all pointless and we're just going to be, you know, plant food at the end and it makes no difference and it's all garbage, I think that fundamentally has the capacity to leave us feeling more helpless and more hopeless than,
for sure,
than is ideal. And so,
I mean, it either leads to, you know, the despair of nihilism, or it leads you to the pleasure seeking of hedonism. Mm. And neither of those places leave us feeling joyful.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that's a kind of fantastic wrapper around this whole thing, is just the idea that the things that help us are the ability to find ways to make peace with the hard things and to hold them lightly, to be able to let go, to forgive, and to recognize that even in some of life's toughest moments, there's often a door towards something so meaningful, so important, and so life-affirming that it's in that space that joy resides. And perhaps the expression of joy then is our ability to let the little things go and show up joyfully for the experiences we have when our kids are refusing to eat their dinner, or,
yes,
you know, screaming about something that the cheese is cut wrong, or I shouldn't say cut the cheese. That's the wrong thing to have chosen.
No, but I understand what you're saying.
Wrong. Or whatever it is, you know, the different things that kids get upset about, but like being able to let that stuff go and just be able to see in that moment, like, you know, when I think about it, I do complain about my children a fair bit. But I have two amazing kids, and the opportunity to see them, to parent them, to be with them is such a privilege. And such,
right, you have something that so many people want and can't have. Like, yeah. I think about all the things that I complain about. The things that I complain about are often, in someone else's eyes, a blessing. So I should be very careful to be grateful for those blessings and not complain about them.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think it is the case of being able to hold lightly, again, and let go of the things and not fight the moment, to accept what is, and within it find the privilege and the gift that each moment brings. Tanya, thank you so much. You've really shed so much light on this topic for me. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Well, it is a delight. I kind of have come to the place in my life, I don't really have a lot of time for small talk. Like, either we're going to talk about the meaning of life, the universe, and everything, as Douglas Adams put it, or we're not going to talk at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you've really given us a lot to think about, and a lot of comfort as well. And I think for people who are facing really some of life's toughest things, I think what you've shared today may help them go into it and see the little glimmers that exist within some of the stuff that people may be facing right now. So thank you.
You know, it's funny. When I was having that conversation with Tanya, that thing I said at the end about people going through tough things, I said it with somebody in mind. Somebody I know who's just lost her husband. She has three young children. And I was thinking about all that she's going through. She's been on my mind a lot. And then a couple of hours after this conversation, I got a call from the doctor because I'd had some tests done. And basically, they have found things that now I have to go for more tests to rule out the possibility of bowel cancer. And so now I kind of am on the precipice of potentially my own tough thing. And although there's every likelihood the tests will come back and say, no, it's all fine, you know, here's what it is, just in the gap, there's the possibility of, you know, something big that awaits. And this conversation really got me thinking about what it would mean to show up joyfully through whatever lies ahead. And it's funny, I didn't actually think about the faith part of things until I listened back and I did the editing of our conversation. And I thought about what Tanya would do in my situation and how she would be able to pray and hand some of the worry away, to let go. That I think perhaps the letting go part is much easier to do when your faith allows you to believe that in letting it go, someone else is going to hold it for you. And so I think for those of us who don't let go, perhaps that's the reason, is that we think we have to hold everything because there's nobody else to hold it for us. But when we believe that something, someone else is there, the belief allows us to put stuff down, the stuff that we hold too heavily. And I think we have to be able to do that in order to live joyfully, because I don't think we can live joyfully and carry heaps of heavy crap around. So that's a real kind of practical takeaway for me, because even though I believe in something bigger than myself, I don't think I've ever properly thought about having a deliberate practice of letting go, which when you have faith in God is part of the prayer process, that you hand things to God and you pray and you ask God to take things and help, in much the same way as Tanya described when she was going to Mary's bedside, that she didn't feel capable of doing that. But once it felt like God was going to carry some of that responsibility for her, all she had to do was show up, that became manageable. And in that, she got this, you know, incredible privilege of being there for someone she cared about to see them out of this world, which, you know, I just found that story so powerful. So anyway, so that's the practical thing that I'm taking away from this, is to really consider developing a practice of letting go, one that allows me to deeply feel the ability to let go. So that's what came out of it for me. I hope something amazing and useful came out of it for you too. I know this type of philosophical conversation isn't everyone's bag, so if you've made it this far, I imagine something resonated and you found something useful. I'd love to know what that is. So if you'd like to comment on the blog show notes page, you'll find that at bighappylife.co.uk. This will also be on my personal Facebook page. My name's Natalie Britt. And I will also put it on Instagram as well. So you can find me on Instagram, big_happylife. On the show notes page, you'll also find links to Tanya's book, Leaving the Safe Harbor: The Risks and Rewards of Raising a Family on a Boat. I'd highly recommend it. It's a wonderfully inspiring read, so full of incredible stories that will just make you think about all the possibilities that life holds that perhaps for the majority of us are invisible because we're so busy doing the same. But it does also kind of get you thinking about the ways in which we can all bring adventure and joy and meaning to our everyday lives. If you found this episode helpful and interesting, I would love you to leave a review. The more reviews the podcast gets, the more listeners it reaches. And that, of course, is great for the lifeblood of any podcast. For now, though, thanks for listening.